The Noise of Democracy.
That's what these stories are. They're very personal stories, but at the same time, they're the noise of democracy and all its wildness and strangeness and eccentricity, whether it's New Age healers in New York City or anarchist journalists in the front line of revolution in Mexico. That, to me, is the noise of democracy, and I think I just had to write this.
That's Rolling Stone journalist Jeff Charlotte. We'll talk with him about his terrific book, Sweet Heaven When I Die. And are we living under an inverted totalitarianism?
In classical totalitarian movements, you have a radical force that overthrows a decaying structure and replaces it. In inverted totalitarianism, it is expressed through the anonymity of the corporate state. You have forces, corporate forces, that purport to pay fealty to electoral politics, the Constitution, the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet have so corrupted the levers of power as to render the citizen impotent.
That's Chris Hedges. We'll talk with him about his book, Death of the Liberal Class. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. How do we come to faith? What happens when we lose it? Is it an illusion or a greater path to wisdom? Jeff Charlotte has been examining Americans' peculiar relationship to faith for much of his writing life. He's written extensively about the Christian right in his books The Family and C Street, and talked about it before on this show. Now Charlotte's come out with perhaps my favorite book so far, Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. It's a collection of 13 essays exploring, as one reviewer said, how we gain, lose, maintain, and blindly accept faith. Charlotte writes about some famous believers, like Cornel West, and those lesser unknown. A former left-wing radical turned conservative politician, a Yiddish writer who survived the Holocaust, and a spiritual advisor to high-end Manhattan real estate agencies, who tells Charlotte that doubt is his calling. We aired a segment a few weeks ago about his chapter in Sweet Heaven When I Die about Brad Will, the anarchist video journalist who was shot down in Oaxaca, Mexico several years ago, but whose spirit is alive and well at Occupy Wall Street. Charlotte's been writing about Occupy Wall Street. His most recent article about it is published in the current issue of Rolling Stone. We're posting a web-only segment about that at writersvoice.net. But now, our interview with Jeff Charlotte about Sweet Heaven When I Die. Jeff Charlotte, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Well, thanks for having me again. It's good to be back with you, Francesca.
This wonderful book, Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faithlessness and the Country in Between, is a very different kind of writing than the writing that I've read of yours and talked with you about before, although you may have written before in this way. These are very personal portraits that you create in this book. You've been following faith and faithlessness in America for a long time. Could you tell me a little bit about, tell us, how did this book come about? Why did you decide to write it like this?
Well, this book is, some of these are new pieces, and some of them are pieces I've been writing over the last 10 years. It's a collection of 13 stories that I thought fit very well together. And they were really the stories I realized that during this long period when I had been writing a lot about this very authoritarian subculture of American fundamentalism, in which I was deeply immersed, living with these folks, traveling with these folks, reporting on these folks, going to their archives. And these are the stories that I would sometimes go off to write to keep myself sane. And that gets complicated because a couple of them are about fundamentalism, so I didn't get very far. But they're also about all sorts of other people. They're about, I was writing about this fundamentalist group that we've talked about before called The Family, the C Street organization. And they had sort of a slogan for many years, which was this idea that they helped politicians make decisions away, this is the phrase, away from the din of the vox populi, away from the voice of the people. Mm-hmm. Well, there's another phrase with which I ended my last book, C Street, from America's worst president in American history. It's not George W. Bush. It was James Buchanan, right before the Civil War. But he had one good line when people were trying to sort of say, now let's sort of suppress the debate and so on. He said, "I like the noise of democracy." So that's what these stories are. They're very personal stories, but at the same time, they're the noise of democracy and all its wildness and strangeness and eccentricity, whether it's New Age healers in New York City or anarchist journalists in the front line of revolution in Mexico. That, to me, is the noise of democracy, and I think I just had to write this. I had to hear that noise after that long immersion in fundamentalism.
And what's the connection between democracy and faith?
What's the connection between democracy and faith? That is a good question. Well, you know, maybe put it like this. What was that famous Gandhi quote? You know, he says, "I think American democracy is a good idea. You should try it." I'd like to see a democracy someday. I'd like to see, you know, I live in New Hampshire. I'd like to see a moose. I'd like to see democracy. You know, these are, in some ways, they're things that we take on faith. But not sort of the blind faith, but the faith that leads you into action, into doing things. So, you know, when I speak of faith, faithlessness, and the country in between, I'm using these terms very broadly, too. Faith is not simply spirituality in that kind of nice sort of liberal sense, nor is it simply religion in that kind of more rigorous conservative sense. Faith has to do with belief, about keeping heart, and faithlessness is also more complicated than I think people recognize. Faithlessness, people think, oh, that's bad, that's no good. No, faithlessness is you've lost faith in something. You don't believe in something. And there are times when it is not good to believe in things. There's times when, you know, the veil is lifted and you see things as they really are. But mostly we live in between. So that sort of that's a relationship for me between democracy and faith and runs you through the whole subtitle.
Yeah. You know, we're living in a time now very much where it seems finally the veil is being lifted. You know, we just before we started recording this interview, we were talking about going down to, both of us have gone down to Occupy Wall Street, and this movement is going, it's kind of like the emperor's new clothes, you know. You actually wrote in this book, Sweet Heaven When I Die, about someone that you have now seen again at Wall Street. It's in the story about Brad Will. So it actually, you know, tell us who you've met, but then let's talk about Brad Will before we get back to maybe talking about what's going on right now.
Sure. Well, I almost sort of feel like I've met Brad Will, who's no longer alive. I almost feel like I met him down there, Occupy Wall Street. He was an anarchist activist, and then as he got into his 30s, became a journalist, and toward the end of his life, became a good journalist, and died in 2006, covering a revolt in Oaxaca, Mexico. Videotaped his own murder, covering a confrontation between police and protesters, and they opened fire. And if you slow that videotape down slow enough, you can see the puff of white smoke. And then bang, he falls down. But Brad lived for this kind of thing. Brad, in New York City, you know, we talk about these people occupying this park in New York City. Brad was, I don't want to call him a leader. He didn't believe in leaders. But Brad was a catalyst. He was one of the people who was just there being, who helped save New York City's community gardens when Giuliani decided he wanted to privatize them. And he died in 2006, but his spirit was very much there down at Occupy Wall Street. And in fact, I ran into one of his old and best friends, a woman who is in the book both by her I guess, birth name, Priya Reddy, and as her nom de guerre, I guess, War Cry, which she chose when she's younger and has a sense of humor about now, calling herself War Cry. But, you know, War Cry, she met Brad when they were doing forest defense. Brad was a tree sitter, one of these folks who go up in the big, big tall trees and sit down there so you can't cut it down, and they became friends. And she's also, in this book, I know about that white puff of smoke when you slow down the video incredibly slowly because Warcry herself, a video activist, is the one who's done that. And interestingly, Warcry is also one of the people who, in some ways, broadcast Occupy Wall Street to the world. She was one of the people who videotaped many listeners probably saw this. This was international news. A police officer reaching over a barrier to get closer to a woman who was already contained, hadn't been doing anything, was contained, wasn't going anywhere, and to blast her with a sustained blast of pepper spray in the face. And I think that woke a lot of people up. And War Cry, there's a couple people who videotaped that. War Cry was one of them. So you go down to Occupy Wall Street and you see these anarchists. I feel like I'm encountering the whole cast of my book down there. Cornel West is the subject of an essay called Begin with the Dead. He's been down there. I wouldn't be surprised if I went to Occupy Philadelphia and encountered some of the folks I wrote about there who were trying to, back when I was writing about them, trying to resist the giant Clear Channel media monopoly. And suddenly you find this book that was not written as a political book, but when we are at these moments of great cultural change, you know, the line between politics and everyday experience, that line starts to fade. This is about people being alive. And some of the most alive people around are in this movement, and they also happen to be in the book.
And reigniting faith out of a loss of faith.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And that's what I was trying to get at with faithlessness. And maybe, you know, the person who I think really expresses that best is Cornel West. And the way that story came about is I write for Rolling Stone, and my editor there said, you know, will you write a story about Cornel West? And I said, no, I don't want to. I think we all know that story. He's a very public figure, the great philosopher, theologian. And I think I know what this is about. My editor said, well, read the books. Immerse yourself. Immersion journalism can be just as much about being in the library as it can be being in the streets. And when I read the books that nobody reads, especially the people who say, oh, Cornell is just a, you know, he's just a huckster. They're amazing, stunning, powerful, powerful books. Prophesy Deliverance, The Evasion of American Philosophy. These are not the bestsellers, but they're worth reading.
And why?
Well, precisely for what you said there, that the idea of reigniting faith out of faithlessness, of hope out of despair, that Cornell speaks of, once I interviewed him over a period of about a year, would go down, Cornell speaks of what he calls the death shudders that he's been experiencing since he was a young man, this acknowledgement of mortality. You know, the simple truth that the moment you're born, you begin to die. That's just reality. And that when you engage with that, he finds that an incredibly invigorating kind of sensibility. But also in the recognition of, you know, you don't hide from pain or suffering. You confront it. So now, Cornell is a very Christian man, very radical left Christian man, very devout. And he explains his Christianity to me. He says, it's not the Christianity of Good Friday, of Christ crucified on the cross, that gory crucifixion, you know, that Mel Gibson Passion of the Christ kind of look at the blood Christianity. And it's not the Christianity of Easter Sunday, Christ risen, you know, sort of happiness and joy and all this kind of stuff. He says, because that's not where we're at. We're in the long Saturday in between. And this is true whether or not you're a Christian. I'm not a Christian, but I think he's got something here. That long Saturday in between, you believed in something. You believe that Jesus was your Savior, and then he's dead, and he's supposed to come back. But where is he? Where is he? That's where we're at. And when you ask that question, where is he? The answer Cornell comes up with is, in some ways, a very deeply human answer. You're going to have to do this. No more waiting.
Yeah, you know, and what struck me also is how he, you know, I think you said, you know, how he draws the hope out of the despair. I mean, how he talks about democracy, you know, he says, democracy, you know, the original sin of America, as you write in this book, Sweet Heaven When I Die, Jeff Charlotte, you write that he says the original sin of America was not slavery, it was the annihilation of, you know, something like 95% of the indigenous peoples of America, and yet it was out of that annihilation that democracy would not have been possible in some ways without that. I mean, that's such a hard idea to get your mind wrapped around.
That's what Cornell calls some deep blues, some real deep blues. You know, he looks at blues music as a metaphor that extends far beyond the music, that African-American musical tradition. I mean, he'll say Chekhov is a blues man. But he also, you know, exactly, that you go, you go back to the thing. I mean, you know, as you said, that to explain that a little bit more, democracy is impossible without some room for people to stand up on their own. They cleared that room by killing Native Americans, and that's not an unfortunate accident. That's right at the heart of things. That's right at the heart of understanding what he would say. And I think a lot of the stories in this book turn on not the idea of loss of innocence, but innocence. What are you talking about, innocence? We're not innocent. You know, what's interesting in the book is that the most conservative person in it and the most radical, liberationist, revolutionary person in it both believe in original sin. And maybe that's why I like them. I think writers all believe in original sin. Original sin is you know, that's the beginning of the story. You can't have a story if you think we're going to just perfect ourselves and tidy everything up, and that'll be that.
Right.
That's IKEA furniture, not human life.
Who was the person, the fundamentalist who, are you talking about here?
Oh, Vera? The most conservative, that's true. I guess, that is true that the most conservative fundamentalist, Ron Luce, the leader of the battle cry movement, certainly believes in original sin. He believes in original sin, secondary sin, sin tomorrow, sin yesterday, and right now we're sinning. The more interesting conservative, he's not the most interesting person in the story of his movement. The more interesting people there are the kids who forged their own way. But the more interesting conservative is the subject of the longest essay in the book, the first story, the title of which I cannot say on radio, Sweet F All Colorado. And I'm not a person, I don't like to think of myself as a vulgar person. I followed the story. That was the name of a bar I encountered on this sort of trip I took out to Colorado to visit an old friend who had been a radical leftist back in the day when I knew her. My college girlfriend, practically our first date, was me bailing her or picking her up from jail for civil disobedience during the Gulf War. And over the years, she had gone back to Colorado where she was from, and she'd become a conservative, she'd become a Republican, she'd become a rising star in the Republican Party. She became a lawyer. She was running for DA in this vast rural Colorado district. She ran. She campaigned on horseback. She had a fake shootout as a fundraiser. I mean, she campaigned on the myth of the West, and so there's that deep conservatism. But she was always one of the most brilliant people I knew, one of the best writers, and, you know, some of the best lines in this book are hers, you know, quoting her letters, because she's a fabulous writer. And in some ways, it was that sense of original sin that united us and allowed us to continue having a conversation. The idea that innocence is a delusion, and that's not a dark or cynical thing to say at all. That's about the most hopeful thing you can say.
Why?
Because innocence isn't human. We're human beings. Because the flip side of despair is not optimism, it's desire. And that's the sort of the animating sort of what ties these 13 stories together. All people walk in this tightrope between despair and desire, between the recognition of how things are and desire, which is another word that gets a bad rap. You know, it's lustful and selfish. No, desire is the recognition of yourself in relationship to the world. It's the both are, to link it back to Cornel West, he defines the most essential human dignity, as he says, as the ability to contradict what is. The beginning of imagination, of political imagination, is not an affirmation, it's a negation. It's the folks down at Occupy Wall Street. They begin with a negation, and you see that very literally when you go down there. I was talking to a woman who come from New Orleans, and she said, you know, you get here, she says, look, we've been occupying New Orleans for 6 years, you know, since Katrina. And she said, I was so angry when I got here, and I just said, you know, I had my tax the rich sign, and I was angry. I hadn't laughed in years. And she says, and I still believe those things. She said, but now I'm involved in making this community, making this incredibly strange, temporary, lively community, and so on. But it was the negation that said, you know, to her literal circumstances, to the country that talked a lot about New Orleans but turned its back on its suffering, she said, no, I contradict that. I'm going to go up to Wall Street and contradict that. That no allows the yes. The darkness allows the light. And, you know, I sound like I'm preaching here, but really, this is a book of stories. But they're stories that, to me, I mean, you ask why I wrote them. They're stories because these are the stories that, as I said, kept me sane, that gave me some hope, and that's how they function like that.
Yeah, there's one story in there. I mean, they're all powerful stories. But I was very profoundly affected by the story of Chava Rosenfarb. I mean, of all the people, you know, who's kind of been to hell and back, she's a Holocaust survivor. She was in the ghetto in Lodz. She became a writer out of that experience, but the writing first came from her encounter with the Psalms, and it wasn't about God.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I'm glad you asked about that. There's two stories about Chava becoming a writer. Maybe I just run through them both very quickly. Everyone asked about the other one. I'm glad you asked about the Psalms. She's in the Łódź ghetto, and she gets a job translating Psalms into Yiddish. And she's working with a rabbi, and she's a young Yiddish writer. She's basically doing it at first because she wants hot coffee. You know, she's starving, just something hot. And okay, I'll work with you. This is a rabbi who's sort of working for the Germans. You know, no innocence here. There's all just shades of collaboration. And this is her discovery of poetry. And she's a secular person. She's part of that, you know, that great Eastern European socialist world and Jewish life. And for the rabbi, it is religious. For her, it is beauty. And I'm not going to, you know, there's people out there who lean one way or the other. It's both, you know. Which is it? Yes, is the answer.
You mean beauty and spirit.
And everything else. I mean, you know, the one thing that all writers, going back to David the Psalm writer, all writers learn is when you write a text and you publish it, it's not yours anymore. People are going to do with it what they want, and that's a good thing. That's a democratic thing. But the second story I wanted to tell of how Chava became a writer, and Chava is really, she was the last great Yiddish writer, I think it's fair to say. She died the day before this book went to press. In some ways, you know, you go on radio to sell your own book, and I hope you all buy it, but if you have to choose Der Baum von Leben. It's an English translation. It's a terrible translation, but it's still worth reading. It's fantastic. The Tree of Life. Chava Rosenfarb. And her real life as a writer began in a concentration camp. A German guard gave her a pencil. He was a sympathetic guard, gave her a pencil, just, here's something. She hid it in her shoe. She got back to her barracks. Her bunk was the top bunk, nose was up against the sort of the wood ceiling. And she would lie there in bed, and she would write poems, remembering those Psalms. She would write poems and until the pencil was just a nub, and it was gone. And that was it. No more writing. So she would memorize the poems. She would recite the poems. Later, she went from that work camp to Bergen-Belsen, and she would recite the poems and recite the poems. And remember, every time she recites those poems, that's a contradiction of what is. That is a negation of this world around her. She's saying, no, this is I refuse to accept this as the only world. And she imagined these poems, and she did survive. And that those poems in her memory became her first published book of poems. That's a pretty good way to start off as a writer.
Yeah. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Jeff Charlotte about his latest book. It's a wonderful collection of essays about faith and faithlessness in America. It's called Sweet Heaven When I Die. The essay about Chava Rosenfarb is called For Every Life Saved. It's part of a quote from something Rosenfarb said, "For every life saved, an other must be sacrificed." I asked Jeff Charlotte what he thought that view of Rosenfarb's came from.
Yeah. Well, that comes from a discussion of actually my favorite of her. The Tree of Life is the sort of the towering work of life in the Łódź ghetto. But there's a novella called Edge's Revenge. And the plot is very complicated, so I won't sum it up. But it's about two women, one of whom was a capo, two Jewish women, one of whom was a capo, a collaborator in the camps. And they encounter each other many years later in Montreal. And, you know, one has a secret. The capo had saved the other one. It gets complicated. But the secrets go back and forth. And the reader who goes into this, you know, expecting an easy vengeance tale, you're going to be let down. Expecting a tale of, you know, the triumph of forgiveness, you know, go to the church if you're looking for that. None of these things are there. This is the moral balance shifts back and forth between these two women. There is no clear, pure heroism that one gets to be the good guy. I mean, obviously, in the Holocaust, The Nazis are the bad guys. There's no question of that. But even there, you get the German guard who saves Hava by giving her a pencil. For every life saved, another must be sacrificed. And I think Hava knew that about that pencil. The other thing the German guard gave her was a slip, a white cotton slip. And for all she knows, if that was the edge, that she could hide it under her work clothes because women were freezing to death. And maybe that saved her. But there's nothing good or innocent in that because she has to live for the rest of her life. I took the slip and I lived. Who died?
Yeah.
But I always say that that's not, the story doesn't end there. That's where the story begins.
That's where the story begins.
Yeah, I think so. I think so for Hava, it certainly did. Uh-huh. Hava wrote and wrote and wrote, wrote right up to the end of her days. There was a sense in which she could never leave the Holocaust behind, but that didn't paralyze her. I think she was writing in some ways to write herself free, and she couldn't do that, but she didn't stop trying.
Right, exactly. So there, as you say, like Cornel West is saying, you know, democracy coming out of, you know, Holocaust, and here writing and creativity coming out of Holocaust, a different kind, a different Holocaust as well. Another aspect of faith is, you know, how people confront belief and crises of belief and or even the mystery of things that they can't explain. And one of the chapters in your book is about a kind of a modern-day shaman in New York City, a woman named Sondra Shaya. Sondra Shea.
She would probably like that pronunciation better, though.
Yeah, she probably would.
Maybe I have to give you her full title, Sondra Shea. Nay Shavitz, she's born Jewish, B.A., this is on her business card, B.A., M.A., J.D., guide, teacher, adept member of the Great White Universal Brotherhood and Sisterhood of Light, ritual master in the High Council of Gore, universal Kabbalist, Reiki master, metaphysician.
And, you know, when you read that, you think, this is going to be such a charlatan. You know, this woman is just out for the money. She's not. And talk a little bit about her and your own experience of her as well.
Yeah, I mean, I met Sondra because I decided I wanted to write about the economy of sort of New Age religions. And New York, for instance, where I met her, hosts this huge New Age expo, and it's big, big, big business. And I think a lot of people experience those kinds of alternative spiritualities as counterculture, as a contradiction of what is. And there I want to flip it a little bit because there's some deep capitalism going on there. And sometimes it's very transparent. I'd gone to this expo to attend an event on the spirituality of the New York Fire Department after 9/11 and what it can teach you about stock investing, you know, get-rich-quick schemes. And I met Sondra instead. And Sandra's not in it for the money, but Sondra makes money. She likes to point out that, you know, so does the Catholic Church. Sondra makes a lot of her money. This was an interesting thing that I discovered, that a lot of the high-end real estate brokers in New York keep someone like Sondra on call to do spiritual cleansing of apartments that don't move, to draw magic circles around them and things like this.
And it works.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Look at the real estate market. It's not working too well right now.
Well, that's true.
Sondra liked to say, she said, yes, I charge for this. She says, I have to make a living. She says, you know, but the Catholic Church is the biggest real estate holder in the world, which I think that is actually true. But, what I was interested in with her and the way that she reflected it back at me that I thought was very powerful, I ended up going to her workshops, which, again, cost a lot of money, but I got comped, so I got a great deal, several thousand dollars for one of these workshops, and 12 hours, and dancing and singing and all this kind of stuff. And finally, I was ready to graduate to the next level, and I go into this room, and there's Sondra, and she's holding this big sword, and one of the other students says, now, this is not Sondra you're talking to. This is Jesus. She's channeling Jesus. And Jesus says, well, okay, now, what I'm about to tell you is a secret. And I say, Sondra, you know, you know I'm here to write about this. She says, Jesus, call me Jesus. I'm like, okay, Jesus, you know I'm here to write about this. She says, okay, you can tell the gist. And so what she then proceeds to do as Jesus is to narrate my life story back at me. And I had been, you know, hanging out with her and shadowing her, you know, with her permission for about a month. And she'd just been very attentive and picked up every detail. And I think she experienced that as magic, as magical knowledge. And I experienced it as tremendous perception. And there's a little bit there of six of one, half dozen of the other. I fall on the perception side. And she understood that. So Sandra's Jesus says to me, she says, "Now, I know you don't really believe in me. That's okay." She says, "Because doubt is your calling. Doubt is what you do." And she says, "Doubt is not unbelief. It's not belief, and it's not unbelief. It's in between." Oh, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good, you're going to have a mantra for journalism. That's pretty good. She says, "Doubt is your revelation." And if it's unbelief, that's not doubt. That's certainty. So I'm such a doubter, I can't even commit myself to agnosticism. I'm just in between.
I hear you. Jeff Charlotte. We'll talk more with him about his new book, Sweet Heaven When I Die, after the break. Stay tuned.
There's a dark and the troubled side of life. There's a bright and a sunny side too. Though we meet with the darkness and strife, the sunny side we also may view.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Let us greet with a song of hope each day.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with journalist Jeff Charlotte about his newest book, a collection of essays called Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. Just before the break, we were talking with him about Sandra Shaya, a New Age healer based in New York. She did something to you, and you say you nearly fell down. What was that experience?
Oh, the Prima Agni, and I'm trying to remember the particular magic powers of the Prima Agni. It's basically you stand there, and she traces a pattern on your back. Doesn't actually touch you, but sort of traces it over your back and does some stuff and talks and so on. And if you go into this with this open mind, okay, I'm going to experience this as you are, it can have a sort of shocking experience. You're really stunned. It doesn't mean that the magic is real, but it does mean that their persuasion is real. And, you know, because I've written about fundamentalism a lot, you know, I've oftentimes been around people speaking in tongues. And I think a lot of secular liberal people imagine that it's, oh, just a goof, that anyone can do it, and they're just putting it on. And if you spend time around people speaking in tongues, really speaking in tongues, whatever they're doing, they're not just putting it on. They are in an altered state of consciousness. And if you open yourself up to that, you'll get a taste of it, a jolt, a little bit of electricity. I've never spoken in tongues, and the Prima Agni did not actually advance me to some new spiritual level. But it's a reminder that rituals, and even the ritual magic of someone who's got some pretty unusual beliefs, the rituals embed in themselves a kind of a narrative. Mm-hmm. And you will fall into that narrative. You might even fall down.
Now, you come to this in a way uniquely, from your background, uniquely suited to this. One of your parents was Jewish, right?
And my father's Jewish, and yeah, my mother was, mother died when I was young, but she was raised kind of hillbilly Pentecostal and was a little too old to be a hippie, but and wasn't really a seeker. She was more, I would say she was a tourist. She raised me, you know, we went to houses of worship according to the music and according to where her friends sang in a choir, rang a bell, or chanted ashrams and churches and masses and temples and all these kinds of things. And then the other half is Jewish. And so there's an essay in the book called You Must Draw a Long Bead to Shoot a Fish about being a half-Jew. And I decided to write it in the context of a friend who's a half Mennonite. It's about being of a tradition, being of a place, but also not of it. About leaving, you're always an insider and you're always an outsider. And I think that's a condition that many of us find ourselves in one way or the other. If you're a half Jew or a half, you know, something like that, it's more obvious. But not too many of us are pure anything. We are all in between.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was that like as a child? What was your sense, your feelings about religion as a child? Did you think about this as your mother took you to these places, or as you would go to your father's family for Jewish, you know, holidays?
You know, I have always been on a spiritual path, but I haven't. I really haven't. I'm not now. You know, I'm not a seeker,
right.
Which is this funny thing. If you write a lot about religion, people assume that you're a seeker, and they don't quite do the math, because if I was a seeker, I'd be looking to put myself out of a job. You know, I go around, I write about different people's beliefs, and then finally I get, you know, I get to Salt Lake City and Temple Square, and I say, oh, well, this is it. This is the one. That's pretty much the end of my writing life. The interesting thing about it, and this is really not disingenuous, and I hope not offensive to anybody, I could care less whether God or gods exist. I'm interested in what people who believe and don't believe in these things do. I'm interested, you know, I'm a writer. I'm a journalist. I'm interested in what people do in the world and how they're often shaped by things that may or not be real. In my first book, wrote with Peter Manceau. So novelist Peter Manceau and I traveled around the country looking for varieties of religious experience, and we were writing in Hendersonville, North Carolina, writing about a Pentecostal exorcism of an individual who had gone into a church and opened fire with a gun. Fortunately, the gun was filled with blanks, and the church had this very, very right-wing church, but this very interesting reaction. Someone had opened fire on them. They didn't want vengeance. This boy, anyone who would do such a crazy, twisted thing, that person must really be hurting. We got to have an exorcism. They must have demons in them. And the person was in prison. We went to meet the local sheriff. We're sitting there interviewing the sheriff, Thomas Breedlove. He pulls a gun out of his drawer, points it at us, and says, it's just a toy. Don't worry. He says, but now if you had pulled that on me, I would have shot you. Mm-hmm. And that just goes to show you that things that are not real can still hurt you. Things that are not real can still hurt you. Things that are not real can also still help you. They can save you. We are material beings, but our minds are not. And we have to always take both those realities into account.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with journalist Jeff Charlotte about his newest book, a collection of essays called Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. That was Jeff Charlotte. His book is Sweet Heaven When I Die. Go to writersvoice.net to find links to our other interviews with him. And we
sure,
also
once
link to Charlotte's
I was young
essay,
and
recently
impulsive,
published in Rolling Stone,
I wore
inside
every
Occupy
conceivable pin.
Next up,
even
Chris
went
Hedges.
To socialist meetings, learned all the old union hymns. Ah, but I've grown older and wiser. And that's why I'm turning you in. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal.
Liberals have come in for a lot of bashing from the right ever since the Reagan Revolution of the 1980s. But even before that, left-wing radicals had their own critiques of liberals as being the good cops for the ruling class, keeping order by bringing just enough reforms to the system to keep it going. My guest, journalist and author Chris Hedges, grew up in a proud liberal tradition. But his experience as a longtime war correspondent tore the pretty face off whatever liberal illusions he carried from his upbringing. We last spoke to Hedges in 2009 about his book, Empire of Illusion. His latest book, Death of the Liberal Class, was published in 2010 and is forthcoming in paperback from Nation Books at the end of November. We spoke to Chris Hedges last spring, before Occupy Wall Street, but if anything, it's even more relevant now. I waited so long to air it because, as you'll hear, the audio isn't the best. I met Chris Hedges at his hotel in New York, and we had trouble finding a quiet place to do the interview. But it's not all that bad, as it turns out, and as I edited the interview yesterday, I realized just how powerful it is in light of recent events. Chris Hedges has been part of the Occupy movement. He was arrested on November 3rd outside the Goldman Sachs building in Lower Manhattan during an Occupy Wall Street protest. Chris Hedges, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Liberal institutions were created to make the world a better place. They were designed to give a voice to those who are shunted aside, abused, and ignored by the larger society. Throughout their history, they have promised to protect the common good. The core liberal values are built around justice, a sense that all sectors of a society have a right to a decent living and protection from abuse by the powerful. In essence, a belief in the common good. You know, the press, when it works, is designed to give a voice to those within the society who without journalism would have no voice. The liberal class, in essence, works as a kind of safety valve. When there are gross injustices visited upon a population and tremendous grievances, then it provides formal mechanisms within the power structure by which these grievances can be redressed. We saw this in the 1930s with the breakdown of capitalism and the Depression and the rise of the New Deal. We saw it with the Civil Rights Movement. When these institutions do not work, when there is no possibility of rectifying abuses that are being carried out upon your underclass, then, to quote Dostoevsky, who was obsessed with this, it's what his novel Demons and Notes from Underground is about, you enter an age of moral nihilism. You enter an age in which discontent becomes expressed through very frightening totalitarian-based movements. In the case of course, Tsarist Russia, that was Lenin and the Bolsheviks. In the case of the breakdown of the Weimar Republic, it was the Nazi Party. In the case of the collapse of Yugoslavia, it was figures like Slobodan Milosevic or Franjo Tuđman. And in the case of the United States, we're seeing it with groups like the Tea Party, militias, and the lunatic fringe of the Republican Party, which their political agenda is irrational. But what they provide is a channeling for a very legitimate rage. Unfortunately, they channel that rage towards scapegoats, undocumented workers, Muslims, the liberal intelligentsia itself. It's not a new story. And it purports to call for government to get off the backs of the American public, and yet does not advocate an end to unemployment benefits or Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and then, of course, will not confront the military as if the military is not part of government. So the rise of these irrational political movements, something I watched in Yugoslavia and something that happens when liberal institutions no longer work, is catastrophic for a democracy, and that's what we face.
In fact, you call it a kind of inverted totalitarianism.
Well, that's the term of the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin, and Wolin, who probably is our greatest living political philosopher, uses that as a way to describe the system we live under. He said it's different from classical totalitarianism in that it doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader. In classical totalitarian movements, you have a radical a force that overthrows a decaying structure and replaces it. In inverted totalitarianism, it is expressed through the anonymity of the corporate state. You have forces, corporate forces, that purport to pay fealty to electoral politics, the Constitution, the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet have so corrupted the levers of power as to render the citizen impotent. In essence, what the corporations have done is carry out a kind of coup d'etat in slow motion. And I think Wolin is very right about this. Where I break with Wolin is, and I admire him immensely, he talks about how credit and the access to cheap mass-produced goods has provided a kind of, functions as a kind of pacifying technique among the masses. Now, that credit is drying up, and those mass-produced goods are no longer cheap anymore, especially when we look at things like fossil fuel. And I think that we could see ourselves flip, in essence, towards a form of totalitarianism that became much more akin to the classical variety. And I've spoken with Wolin about this. And he agrees that when you take away those two mechanisms by which you have essentially allowed a dispossessed working class to maintain a standard of living that it couldn't afford, in the same way that we maintain an empire through borrowing that we can't afford, that when you take away those mechanisms, that may in fact be the case.
You go back into the history of liberalism, at least in this country, and you mention a couple of figures that I actually grew up fairly close to. They were family friends, Dwight MacDonald and Paul Goodman, who to me in those days when I was a kid, I saw them as radicals, and they were examples to me that I followed when I became what I thought of as a radical in the 1960s. Yet you said that they're liberals. So talk a little bit about them, their legacy, and how did it come so undone?
I'm a huge admirer of Dwight MacDonald, who was an anarchist and, of course, a critic of the liberal class. If I tagged him as a liberal in the book, then I should take it out in the next edition. I certainly never have thought of him as a liberal. I've thought of him as one of the great critiques of the weaknesses of liberalism. Well, the problem, of course, and this began, and it's why I speak about World War I and the rise of the Committee for Public Information, or the Creel Commission, is that Wilson, I think, comes across as a very dark figure in American history, using the Espionage Act, the Sedition Act, as well as the first system of modern mass propaganda to crush radical and populist movements mm-hmm. in this country. Socialists, anarchists, the Communist Party, all of this is a legacy of the Wilson administration. And MacDonald writes about this. He writes about the war, World War I, being the rock on which these populist movements were broken and destroyed. Mm-hmm. And this had disastrous consequences. Until then, the liberal class was a legitimate centrist force. It was balancing between radical forces and the capriciousness of unchecked oligarchic entities like the Rockefellers, the Mellons, J.P. Morgan, Carnegies, and with the destruction of the radical forces. And then, of course, and this again was a legacy of World War I, the perpetual witch hunts for communists, which took place from the end of the war and then, of course, gathered perhaps its greatest momentum in the after World War II. You saw tens of thousands of people, many of whom were not in any way communists, I.F. Stone, our greatest investigative journalist, probably being a good example, pushed out of liberal institutions. Thousands of high school teachers, thousands of social workers, thousands of college professors, screenwriters, actors. And this was, I think, the final sort of death blow, because we didn't have the radical or populist forces that had put pressure on the liberal class to respond in the way they should. And then we saw liberal institutions, in the name of anti-communism, carry out internal purges and weaken themselves to such an extent that by the time we saw corporate forces effectively remove the regulations and controls, many of which have been put in place by the New Deal, we lacked the capacity by which we could fight back.
So are you saying that liberals need radicals in order to stay true to their liberal principles?
Of course, because the liberal class is the reason the liberal class achieves the position that it does within a capitalist democracy is because it serves a very useful function to the power elite, and its destruction by corporate forces is very short-sighted. Its function is this. It posits itself as the moral conscience of the country, and it is used as an attack dog against radicals and radical movements. Mm-hmm. You know, prominent figures like Alan Dershowitz, or go back to Sidney Hook and all of these, they discredit radicals. The figure that American liberals hate most is not Glenn Beck, it's Noam Chomsky, mm-hmm. because the liberal class draws the parameters by which criticism, acceptable criticism, is possible. And when you cross those parameters, you are pushed out of liberal institutions. So, for instance, if you take the war in Iraq, many prominent liberal figures at The Nation or Bill Keller at The New York Times or Michael Ignatieff, I mean, the list is endless, cheerleaded the invasion of Iraq. Now, they did so in the name of humanitarian aims and because Saddam Hussein kills his own people, and they call themselves reluctant hawks and referred to their legacy of opposing the Vietnam War in the case of Ignatieff. And yet, once these figures saw that the war had gone bad, their response was to critique not the motives of the power elite, but the way the occupation and invasion have been carried out, mm-hmm. that we weren't prepared for the insurgency, that we didn't have enough troops, that we were naive. And that's a perfect window into how the liberal class functions. Mm-hmm. It is allowed to carry out that kind of a critique, which incidentally is the kind of critique they were permitted to carry out in retrospective looks at the Vietnam War. But when you cross the line and start challenging the motives of the power elite, then you immediately push yourself out of the liberal class. And that's why Chomsky is a pariah, and a pariah to the liberal media. He's blacklisted on NPR, blacklisted on PBS, because that's what he does. And unfortunately, sometimes the motives of the power elite are as dark as Noam Chomsky mm-hmm. paints them to be. I would certainly say that was the case of Rumsfeld and Bush and Cheney and Pearl and the rest. And the liberal class is traditionally given its positions of influence and privilege because it protects against that kind of an analysis being disseminated throughout mainstream society.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Chris Hedges about his book, Death of the Liberal Class. A seminarian at one time, Hedges is motivated by a profound moral vision, an uncompromising vision. He did not vote for Barack Obama, for example, in the last election, but for Ralph Nader. I asked him if that kind of unwillingness to compromise consigns radicals to irrelevancy.
Well, I would argue that the problem and the reason the liberal class is so detested, especially among our disenfranchised working class, is because it walked away from even the minimal values of liberalism, i.e. the right to organize, social service programs that had protected workers' support for a political party, in this case the Democrats, who pushed through NAFTA, which was the greatest betrayal of the working class in this country since the 1948 Taft-Hartley Act, and that the anger towards liberals by this kind of permanent underclass that we have created, 40 million Americans who live now in poverty, tens of millions of Americans who live in a category called near poverty, is totally justified, and that unfortunately, though, that the anger towards a bankrupt liberalism comes with it an anger towards liberal values, which I actually care about. Mm-hmm. And you see it. You see it in the Tea Party, that they are working overtime to paint a figure like Obama as a liberal or a socialist, when in fact, of course, the Democratic Party, if you placed it in Europe, would be considered a far-right party.
As I mentioned before, I spoke with Chris Hedges last spring, well before the movement of the 99%. In his book, Death of the Liberal Class, Hedges shows how that class has failed the 99% and how the roots of Occupy Wall Street were sown in that failure.
You have to remember that the hypocrisy of the liberal class has been exposed. Mm-hmm. They continue to communicate in this feel-your-pain language while they cravenly serve the interests of Wall Street. We can't even find it within ourselves, I mean, forget about restoring habeas corpus. We can't find it within ourselves to put a moratorium on foreclosures or bank repossessions. We are forcing American citizens to buy defective health insurance policies and passing this so-called health care reform bill, which is just the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for the pharmaceutical and insurance industries, $400 billion in subsidies. It's disgusting. And so I think the anger is directed at a liberal class that is completely duplicitous mm-hmm. in a way that the right wing is not. They're duplicitous in another way, and that they channel that rage towards weak figures, undocumented workers, Muslims, these groups. And this is what all sort of classical totalitarian movements do. They give expression to that rage. Mm-hmm. And the failure of the liberal class is that it still speaks in the dead language of policies and issues and hasn't grasped that its very credibility at this point rests with its capacity to make that rage their own. And the longer they don't do it, the worse it gets.
And so going forward, where do we go from here? You're not really arguing for a resurrection of the liberal class. I think you're arguing for something more fundamental that can cross the divisions that you've been talking about.
Well, the liberal class, when it functioned, made incremental or piecemeal reform possible. Always limited, never enough, but enough to take the pressure off. Mm-hmm. Now the liberal class doesn't work anymore. And as things deteriorate, there is no internal safety valve. And those of us who care about a society that's not reconfigured along the form of the neo-feudalism that's taking place and the solidification of an oligarchic elite and the further disempowering and repression of especially this kind of permanent underclass, I have to turn our backs on all of these liberal institutions and begin to agitate. But we're starting almost from zero because the radical movements have been destroyed. The infrastructure of liberal institutions are dysfunctional, number one, and number two, totally inhospitable to those of us who would challenge the superstructure of the corporate state. But if we don't do it, then all opposition will be ceded to these very frightening proto-fascist movements, from the Tea Party to whack jobs like Sarah Palin or Glenn Beck, or, I mean, the list is sort of, but these are very frightening figures.
Yeah.
And the only hope left is that we turn on the liberal class and we turn on these liberal institutions with the same kind of venom that the hard right has turned on them, because their critique of these institutions, at least their understanding of their hypocrisy and hollowness, is correct.
And a positive? What do we replace that with?
It's very hard to build effective opposition movements without labor in any society. And our labor, I mean, we're watching the last vestiges of labor, the public workers' unions, be destroyed in states like Wisconsin or Ohio or New Jersey, where I live. And, you know, we almost have to start over. We stood by and allowed ourselves to be stripped of every single mechanism by which we could defend the ordinary citizen. And now we're in deep, deep trouble. But again, it comes back to that moral imperative, that belief that rebellion is a kind of a way to assert our own individuality, our own worth. Camus wrote about this, of course. And whether it's successful or not, penultimately or even ultimately, doesn't matter. We have to give a face, a presence, a vocabulary to those forms of resistance, if nothing else, to keep that vocabulary and that way of responding to power alive.
Chris Hedges. We spoke to him about his book, Death of the Liberal Class. He contributed a terrific essay to the second edition of the Occupy Wall Street Journal. We'll link to that at writersvoice.net. Also, Jeff Charlotte has been active in the movement, not only writing about Occupied Wall Street in the latest issue of Rolling Stone, but also co-founding the online site Occupy Writers. It now has 3,000 writers signed up, some providing original works, among them guests on this show like Francine Prose. There's also some wonderful poems, new poems by Alice Walker, and we'll link to that site and to Alice Walker's poems. We'll also be posting a web-only segment, an update from Jeff Charlotte, about his most recent experiences at Occupy Wall Street and also about Occupy Writers. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.